Rabbi Avi Killip here with Rabbi Avital Hochstein on Sacred Ground. Although right now, actually, we're both in New York City.
Indeed. Hello.
We don't have Elazar Simon with us today because the timing didn't work out, but it's really so nice to be sitting with you in person here.
Thank you. Yeah.
You are here to teach at a seminar, actually, in our yeshiva in New York. We have a rabbinic yeshiva intensive this week. So this is really a work trip for you. First of all, how is it to be here?
Complicated, I have to admit. I've spent a lot of time in New York. I feel very at home in New York, and I feel like a foreigner. The emotions are not exactly in sync. I mean, you walk down the streets in Jerusalem, and you can't avoid the fact that we're in war or at a very, very difficult moment. The situation is glaring at you from every bus stop where there are pictures of people who are kidnapped, many more guns on the streets, and also long faces. They accompany the smiles. It's not that there are no smiles and no laughter. There definitely is. But it's also heavy, and that isn't here.
Yeah, I felt that when I was there, and I actually felt a feeling of when you're here, you have to carry that yourself. And when there, it's a little bit more of a shared burden. I'm curious if you feel that in coming here, you have to carry it differently.
I have good colleagues here who are with me in heart and in spirit. And so I don't feel I need to hold and explain. I walked into the building where I always stay, and there they ask how it is, and they're not as attuned. They're asking me from far, and it's a complicated situation to explain.
I'm so grateful that you're able to be here and to travel. And I want to ask this question, although I know that I always, when I get asked this question when I'm traveling for work, I often say, but would you ask my husband that? And that question is like, how are you able to be here and not home with your kids? But I'm going to ask that question as a lead-in to today's conversation. First of all, how are you able to be here? And second of all, what is it like to be here and to know that your children are still in Israel?
Right. So here is what enables me to leave. They're in very good hands with their loyal father, and they'll go to my parents for lunch tomorrow. And so I totally trust their caregivers and who they're with. And I trust them, and they know to take care of themselves. And I also trust that if they need me, they'll say. And that is a deal I have with my kids, and particularly with the older ones who are soldiers, because them I don't see much. And I looked into the eyes of my son the last time I saw him, and I said to him, remember, if you need me to cancel my trip or if you need me to come back, I will. And he gave me an agreeing nod that I knew. He knew it's true. And so I trust him. I trust him that if he needs, he'll say, but that also since he didn't say, he's fine and he can take care of himself. And that's also a good reassuring feeling.
It sounds really like a beautiful relationship.
Thank you.
I want to push actually on that word need. Needs you in thinking both about what does that need look like? What's the role you're playing for which he might need you?
Right.
And maybe we'll start to expand that more broadly to ask, what is sort of that role of mothers right now, more broadly even of women in Israel and in this war? We are used to at least imagining that we live in a society where people are people and not necessarily men and women. And I think this moment, this war has taken that also, especially in Israel right now. We don't get to say, well, some people are in the army and some people are at home with their kids. It's really much more honest to say many men are in the army serving in reserves, and many women are left at home taking care of kids and family and doing other jobs. You know, we're also reading a lot about the role that women are playing in the army. But we'll start with your experience if you just want to speak to what are you holding? What does it mean to say, if you need me, I'll be here?
I guess part of the identity of a parent is being needed. And part of the changing identity of a parent to growing children and kind of children spilling into adulthood is to let go of that part of the identity. Mm-hmm. You're not needed in the same way. So first of all, I want to own it, that it might be my own narrative that is completely disconnected from where my children are. You know, when a kid is in the army, you want to do their laundry when they come home. You want to have their favorite food around when they come home. You want to give emotional and physical nourishment to kind of send them off for the next few weeks until you see them again. Buy the right cream for the right wound and things like that, mainly because there isn't so much time and you want to kind of take that off them.
Yeah.
I do think there is a role of waiting. Now, even when your life is very full, there is something of waiting when there is a close person who's in the army, which is part of your day-to-day identity, state of mind. I guess the positive side of it, which I'm only realizing now, is that the assumption is that being in the army is temporary, or that extreme situations in the army are temporary, and so this person will come home. But it's there. It's very strongly there.
What does it look like, the waiting? It's something that you do? It's something that you feel? It's something happening in the background? Is it more active?
Look, I think it depends on the person, okay? And it depends on the relationship, right? It's different to wait for a parent to come back from war, for a spouse to come back from war, and for a child to come back from war. It's a different state of mind. It's a different onus, weight on your day-to-day. And also, depending on what you usually do with and for each other, what you would do without that person also will change. I will repeat what you said at the opening, which I think is that we are still in a world where most of the people at home are the women and most of the people on the front lines are the men. And that, I think, shapes something. One of my most feminist friends said in fury this week, "I hate being a damsel in distress." And she was talking about a state of mind and a state of being and in a place of missing her partner, who she defined as her best friend. Mm-hmm. So within that wonderful relationship, she's in distress. Her best friend has disappeared for 4 months.
And is there an element of that language, damsel in distress, that is like a disempowering, I can't solve the problem myself, I'm in need of protection or relying on someone else? Is that part of that experience?
Right. So in a zoom out in society, I think I've actually mentioned this before in our conversations, in a zoom out viewing society, those taking care of those in distress are primarily the men. Mm-hmm. Okay. And those in distress are primarily the women. Now, that's of course not an accurate portrayal of the situation at all. So there's this almost discrepancy between the soldier who protects and yet the women who are as if in the position of not protecting themselves but are taking care of everything in society.
Right, the not doing, that it could feel like, oh, what are women doing right now? They're not serving. Again, not all women. Many women are serving. But the women who are not serving are in fact doing their usual duties. They're doing the duties of the men in their immediate family and often doing jobs, working extra shifts, you know, filling in new roles that they would otherwise not have done, and in some ways are actually holding multiple layers of burden in addition to the waiting and worrying burden.
Right. I think I want to take us to Vayakhel, to the portion that we're reading this week. In a conversation I had just before with Rabbi Aviva Richman, who reminded me the context in which this portion of the week, this Vayakhel, sits. So we've just had the golden calf, but the golden calf ends in war. Now, it's internal war, but there's a lot of death, and there is struggle and a crisis. And then comes our parasha, Vayakhel, which Moses brings everybody. Vayakhel is to congregate. Moses brings everybody, and all these everybodies begin to build the tabernacle. And if we're used to the language of the Torah, they usually use the word for people. And suddenly here in the verses, again and again, there is an emphasis of the women being apart. I'll read some of the verses just so we can hear it. Vayavo ha'anashim al hanashim, and the men and the women came, kol nediv lev, every person of generous heart, heviu, and now there's a list of what the people brought, all kinds of valuable stones and gold and so on and so forth. V'chol isha chachmat lev beyadeha tavu, and every woman with a wise heart sewed or stitched or did some sort of weaving with her hands. V'chol anashim asher nasa liban otana bechochma tavu et ha'izim, and all the women who their heart brought them, raised them with wisdom, again, weaved. And one more verse just so that we hear it again. V'chol ish v'isha asher nadav libam otam lehavi lechol ha'melacha asher tziva Hashem la'asot beyad Moshe. And every man and woman that their heart was generous and brought them to do these works that God commanded in the hands of Moses. So there's something very striking here that the women are explicitly mentioned. And one wonders why.
Yeah.
So one, you might want to say that in a moment of crisis, everyone is needed. With our stereotypical thinking or old-fashioned thinking of divisions of roles in society, we would think the men are there doing the public work. And so there's an emphasis that everyone is on board. Now, I can also disconnect it from the context and say, when there's something really important going on in society, everyone's involved. Also, groups of society, there's sometimes that are more on the sidelines or more in the private sphere, whatever it is. But here there's an emphasis that everyone found a role. And that's interesting to notice.
So in that way, maybe the inclusion of women is meant to underscore everyone, even the women, right? Everyone, even the women, are needed to make this project.
Right. So I think there's maybe three ways to think of this emphasis, and they come up in different ways in Shmot Rabbah and in Bamidbar Rabbah, in the Midrashim that we have on these verses. One way is to say it's emphasized to explain that there was a mess. The second is to say it was emphasized in order to keep traditional roles. And the third is to say it's emphasized to bring up new opportunities. And I'll explain each one. One of the Midrashim says, Ba'im anashim v'nashim be'irbuvia. Okay, the emphasis is that they all came together with again, mixed up together, be'irbuvia, in a mess. Okay, maybe there are moments where gender distinctions, even in a classic world, don't make a difference.
So in that read, the gender falls away, actually, is like when you really just need someone to do a task, then you don't have the luxury of discriminating. Oh, there's a man's task and a woman's task. In those moments, everyone just does everything. It's actually a less gendered picture.
Right. I feel like saying it's me'en olam haba, right? It's a taste of the world to come where we can see the job at hand and we're blind to gender. Right? Everyone just comes to take part. Okay? So there are moments, even in broken worlds, where the job at hand is the most important thing and not who's doing it, because everyone's invited to take part.
Mm-hmm. The Me'en Olam Haba, this is of the world to come comment, is that you like this interpretation.
Is that I like imagining a world where the gender glasses are off and we just see people.
Yeah, it's interesting. I have a different personal inclination.
Right.
I like the gendered world. I'm not ready to let go of the gendered world. I recognize that it causes a lot of problems. And yet there is something that I love about this parsha of seeing the women named and seeing that why, like the language of why, you know, wise-hearted men and wise-hearted women as maybe being a little different and acknowledging, particularly in a moment like this, thinking, you know, as I read the news about what's happening in Israel, like, oh, there might be room at those tables for some wise-hearted women. I think you quoted a suggestion that was offered that said maybe everyone should leave and all of their mothers should join the table instead. I don't know. There's something moving to me about actually the way the Parsha is willing to acknowledge gender.
I listen to you and I think of the work that there is to do to care for fundamentals. Part of what's taking me there is the question of food and who is looking for food and who's hungry and how is that food being taken from those who have it to those who need it? And if more women were involved in that chain, what would that distribution look like?
It's really interesting, and it's definitely in the sort of stereotypical realm of women as providers of food to make sure that everybody ate. Particular Jewish women stereotype, but...
Yeah. So you might like the second midrash that comes up on these verses, which notices that the women sometimes are mentioned in general, but a couple of times are mentioned specifically weaving. And the midrash says, "En chokhmah la'isha ela bapelech." Women don't have wisdom but in one place, which is the weaving...
The spindle.
The spindle, exactly, the spindle. Maybe that's a midrash you like more. It definitely is an essentialist midrash in the way that it perceives men and women and the possible roles of different genders.
Right. So there, instead of the image being men and women came together all mixed up to do all the work, is to say, well, when you need a seamstress, you call on the women. When you need women's work, the women are invited in to do that work, which has all sorts of problems, although... There is something powerful about the fact that the project that they are working on is the Mishkan, is the holiest possible project. It's like God building God's house, and God wants what women have to offer as part of God's house.
Right. And if to continue what you were saying before, if there is different people have different abilities, and we don't like the stereotypes and we don't like the generalizations, but recognizing that different people can contribute different things and to give room to these different contributions in such a amazing endeavor like building the Mishkan or rebuilding a land after war, I'm glad that there's room for different abilities and not just one track of how to build.
Yeah, I'm curious if you want to take us back into the current moment to reflect a little bit on whether you see that happening in the way that we might say, oh, women are only good for the spindle, as opposed to saying the work of the spindle is so crucial and holy. You know, the women aren't on the front lines. They're only at home taking care of the kids. Has there been a shift in appreciation for what that role of being at home is right now?
First of all, the second shift is usually in the dark. The second shift is the term we use for after we finish work, we go home to that second shift of supper and baths and laundry and dishes and so on.
If you're not familiar with it, it comes from a book of sociology that you can look up called The Second Shift.
And there is definitely, first of all, recognition of that second shift. Because we're in a world where men's role at home is changing, the fact that men aren't there suddenly gives a spotlight to how much work that second shift is. Mm-hmm. There's also a borrowing of terminology. In Israel, you'll hear the word gibora, hero, about the women holding down the fort at home.
Yeah.
Okay, which is language you'd usually use for the battlefield. Now there's a recognition that maybe it's not a battle, but it definitely is something that takes tremendous energy, power. It's difficult. It's challenging. So there definitely is room for talk about that environment and how much support that environment needs.
A window, I think, exactly that language of heroic, of naming it as something heroic, a heroic task.
The third take, right, if the first one was that it's just a mixture of people coming, the second one being more an essentialist view, the women did what would stereotypically be considered women's work. The third take is in the Midrash in the following language, Ve'ata tedaber el kol chachmei lev, you will speak to anyone of wise heart, lerabot hanashim, including the women. And there's a impression that the women were doing all the roles. When I was a kid, my mom was called up to do reserve duty where she was taught how to drive an ambulance. Mm-hmm. And there were other women taught how to drive buses and so on. And the idea was if all the men would be taken to war, there would be needed women to do the roles that in society usually the men do.
Right, right. This is the American sort of icon of this is Rosie the Riveter, the we can do it image of the way that women in World War II stepped in to take over the roles that the men were not here to play.
Right. So I think we see it in Israel in a few realms, right? One is like the one I'm describing with my mom, of like these bus drivers, ambulance drivers that are usually done by men, okay? Another is, at least at the beginning, there was a feeling that government is absent. And so a lot of services that we would expect government to give, it took time for government to kick into. And so the women were both giving the services and managing the volunteers who were offering those. So it was a lot of work of management that women were doing. I know two or three women who started schools because the people who were the mefunim, who couldn't live anymore, both up north and down south, needed schools. And so women open schools like that on the spur of a moment.
That's interesting. I had heard this sort of narrative, this phenomenon of the ways in which government was both overwhelmed and or maybe distracted to do a lot of the work that was needed in terms of immediate response, that in the sort of more informal power structures that emerged, the volunteer power structures, women were able to play a more prominent role.
You know, it's true also about synagogue, because synagogues that had younger populations suddenly didn't have men around. And in many of the traditional synagogues, the men are the ones who take on all kinds of the classic roles. And those that are a little bit more open to women taking on roles had to ask themselves how to regroup, how to rearrange. Should they enlarge the role of women? What should it look like? Okay, some of them decided not to meet, and others, women had to rise up to the occasion in a more extreme way than usual.
Yeah, it's really interesting. There's a way in which this moment has pushed gender backwards, and maybe there are places and areas where either it's pushed gender forward or it at least presented the opportunity to push forward. I know that Hadar in Israel is doing a really interesting initiative around this parsha, actually, if you want to share a little bit.
Yes, I'm happy to share. Look, one of the biggest dilemmas is initiatives that you planned before the war. Do you do them now or not?
Right.
And one of the initiatives we had thought of was to mark a Shabbat in which women who have not had opportunity to read from the Torah before, in many different synagogues all together in parallel, will take on to read this Shabbat. And both because time has passed, we're already 4 or 5 months into this new reality, and from recognizing that women suddenly had a new place in synagogue because so many of the men were gone, we decided to go ahead with it. And so in a few 20, 30 synagogues all over the country, women will take on Shabbat reading for the first time. And it's both an opportunity to mark, maybe even to celebrate, and mainly to pay attention and give opportunity.
And that's happening this Shabbat, Parashat Vayakel.
Yeah, Parashat Vayakel, exactly, in very many synagogues, north and south and center.
And there's something so moving about doing them all at the same time, that getting up to read from the Torah, you have Gabayim on either side of you, but really you feel like you're doing it alone, and to get to do it, to know that there are other women also stepping up for the first time is really beautiful.
Right, and I'll add to that I think in the same way, community is something where people come together. But when you're a community alone, there's something very lonely. When there's a project you face alone, even if there's a group of you, it's lonely. And this is a moment of a community of communities, okay? It's part of why we thought we should do it in one Shabbat all together, okay? To create a community of communities that are all facing this together.
It's beautiful.
I'll go back with that to something you said before, which I think is important on many realms at the moment in Israel and in general. I think you're right that there is danger and opportunity. People speak of the slippery slope. And the slippery slope, you never know if the extreme of it is a disaster or is perfection. Okay? Mm-hmm. It depends, right, on your perspective. And what I mean here is both about war and about the roles of women. In other words, war is the ultimate danger because of death. And it's also the ultimate opportunity because there could be peace.
Mm-hmm.
And war, the ultimate danger is that we will forever fight. And the opportunity is a new order. there is opportunity for new order. And I think in the topic that we talked about today, in the sense of women, because still, even though my mom drove the ambulance and I see so many friends of my kids, the women there are choosing to go to combat, there is still, I think, danger of going back to very classic gendered roles, which mainly are a danger because they don't give choice.
Yeah.
They force us into a box. And on the other hand, simultaneously, there are so many options that have opened up. Okay, like you described post-World War II in the States and in general, that there was a step up in feminism. And I think it's because we suddenly see women take on roles and do things their own way, do things differently, and just able to do in general. I think there's it's this question of, does war take away agency or give us opportunity for more agency? And there, I guess, is my statement of hope. I'm a half-full cup person. And so I think we have choice if to feel stuck and that our agency was taken, or if to rise to the occasion and see it as an opportunity. Many women are stuck in situations that they haven't chosen, and that needs to be recognized, and we have to create a world where there's more choice. But there's also a lot of opportunity simultaneously to take on agency in old realms and in new realms. And that's something worth embracing. Like these women in the Torah, Kol isha chachmat lev beyadeha, right? Every woman with a wise heart could hold with her hands, do with her hands.
Thank you so much. I know these are not easy topics to talk about, and people have such strong feelings. And I really found this helpful, the different ways of thinking about this and the importance of setting our sights on where we hope this ends up and not just sort of waiting to see how it shakes out, but figuring out the vision of what we believe is possible and how we can get there. So thank you.
Thank you.
The music is Jericho at Dusk by Alon Peretz. Thank you to Sam Greenberg, Jeremy Tabak, and Effie Unterman for producing this podcast, and to David Chabinsky for recording and editing this episode.